Good afternoon. My name is Randy Scott. I'm the comic book librarian here, including comic strips and, to some degree, editorial cartoons. Tangentially. Paul has given me a short biography to tell you. It's very short. Paul's on the MSU teaching faculty in the ATL department. He's published articles and book chapters in American Literature and American Humor. He's published a book on Southwestern humorist Johnson J. Hooper. His fiction and satire have appeared in Harper's and various literary magazines, as well as the National Lampoon, and he was a contributing editor to the National Lampoon. This afternoon, we celebrate Paul's new book from Greenwood Press, titled Editorial Cartooning and Caricature, a Reference Guide. And as a comic book librarian, as comic art librarian, I have to say that this is quite an event. 1998 was a big year for the comic art collection in terms of scholarly result. Two dissertations and two books arrived that all were in some significant part made here at the comic art collection. Let me run down the titles real quick. Genre and Evolution of the American Comic Book Industry. The American Comic Book, A Cultural History. Comic Strips and Consumer Culture, 1890 to 1945. And of those three authors, one is now in Germany, one is in Australia, and one is in Ohio. All three spent weeks here using our collection, and that's nice. The comic art collection has helped dozens of books be created over the last 20 years, but it's especially nice to have the first one published by somebody from here at home. I hope it's the beginning of a trend, and thank you very much for that, Paul. And tell us about it.
Unaccustomed as I am to being wired. I'd like to thank Randy, Ruth Ann, and the library for inviting me. Ruth Ann especially, who invited me, and also thank you for your open-hearted generosity in offering me what I took as carte blanche to have transparencies made. And I had transparencies made. Actually, Teresa Moore made them. She's not here. She didn't say anything, but I don't think she ever wants to see another editorial cartoon again. But thank you. As far as the book is concerned, it was completed with the assistance of an AURIG grant from the College of Arts and Letters and help with mailing and telephone expenses from the Department of American Thought and Language. My colleague and friend Nancy Pogel was with me originally. She left the project years ago in answer to a higher calling. But I see some of the librarians who have helped me here. Thank you very much. I enjoyed writing the book, even though it is a reference book. And a high point was going to the Library of Congress in the summer. We have a lot here. Some things come through interlibrary loan, but a lot of this special collections material does not travel. I don't know how many of you have been to the main reading room in the Library of Congress. There's the majestic rotunda with the statuary. It must be five stories high, the curved rows of polished reading desks. And amid this hushed splendor, the banks of busy scholars, there would be one person, just one person, who would be giggling, and that would be me. I felt the way I felt in high school when I'd go to the library and read Thurber and Benchley and try to keep from laughing. But that's a central truth about editorial cartooning. It may be funny, but does that mean it's trivial? Well, you could ask Boss Tweed or Horace Greeley or James G. Blaine or Richard Nixon about that. What I'm going to do today is to show you a lot of editorial cartoons in fairly rapid succession, since I have 1,000 of them, to give an impression of the sheer volume, the sheer weight of these graphic images. Okay, we'll start at the beginning. This is Franklin's famous Join or Die. It was the first political cartoon in an American newspaper. It was in Franklin's Pennsylvania Gazette for May 9th, 1754. Franklin also did the first editorial cartoon, Non Votus or the Wagoner and Hercules, which is not very interesting, 1747 for the pamphlet Plain Truth. Okay, this is in imitation of it, James Gilray's The American Rattlesnake, produced in London, commemorating the encirclement and the surrender of the British forces. And even today, well, not quite today, 1987, this is by Draper Hill, editorial cartoonist of the Detroit News. Draper is the, I'd say probably the leading American authority on editorial cartooning. Unfortunately, he does not have time to publish much as a working journalist. He's the one the professors call when they are stumped. But there's Opus, the Penguin, Burke Breathitt's character from Bloom County, telling Franklin that that things are changing as the cartoons, cartoonists relentlessly refer to each other and even to themselves. Here's another early one. It's The Able Doctor or America Swallowing the Bitter Draft. And this is from the Royal American Magazine, June 1774. It was engraved by Paul Revere from the London Magazine, and most of the cartoons relating to the Revolution, and many of them were favorable to the colonies, originated in England and were copied here. And originally the colonies were represented by a bare-chested Native American woman. You can see the indignities to which she is being subjected. And here is Paul Revere's most famous engraving. Henry Pelham engraved one called The State Street Massacre. And there's a letter existing. It was in Pelham's papers, a draft, chastising Revere for plagiarizing it, saying this is the worst thing of which you could be guilty. But there's no record of whether it was sent, no record of his response. But anyway, that is sort of the way it was with engravings. There were not that many original artists. And this was propaganda. None of the colonists are throwing stones at the soldiers, but this had a lot of impact as a piece of propaganda. Okay, this is from the campaign of 1800. That's Thomas Jefferson, and he's about to cast the Constitution into the flames on the altar to Gallic despotism, and the American Eagle is stopping him. And you can see all the dangerous documents that are being burned there also. There are very few cartoons from this period because people just didn't save them. There are verbal descriptions of cartoons attacking George Washington, but as I say, it just seemed inappropriate to save them, and so apparently no one did. Here is another famous one. This is, we're up to 1812. Elkanah Tisdale engraved this for the Massachusetts Sentinel, Sentinel with a C. And this added a word to our language. There's President Andrew Johnson, and he is pampering, he's feeding the Southern Dragon. In the outline there, I promised a section, a digression on men in dresses. Since traditionally, and it's not just our satire, this was a way of diminishing a man, a male public figure, by portraying him in a dress, but we're going to run along anyway. Okay, maybe just one. Maybe later. Remember this from the Bush campaign. This is Pat Oliphant, 1988. And this is what editorial cartoons can do. George Bush was a bona fide war hero, but Gary Trudeau and Doonesbury portrayed him as a wimp, and Oliphant had him carrying a purse for I don't know how long. Then Oliphant retired the purse after Desert Storm, and then after President Bush threw up on the Japanese premier, I think, wasn't it? Oliphant had him carrying a barf purse after that. So absolutely unfair and very difficult to fight. Okay, returning sort of to chronology, we'll talk about Thomas Nast. Thomas Nast came to New York City from Germany in 1846 at the age of six. He was fascinated by the great English cartoonists John Leech and John Tenniel. Tenniel's cartoon of the British lion and the Bengal tiger was one of Nast's favorites, and he would one day say that he was indebted to Tenniel for his striking use of animals as symbols. He studied drawing at the Academy of Design, worked for Frank Leslie's Weekly, and he did reporting, just illustration for years. During the Civil War, his illustrations for Harper's Weekly were extremely popular. He soon turned to a more emblematic, less repertorial style, which was sometimes allegorical and nearly always emotionally powerful. So effective a voice for the Union did he become that Lincoln called him our best recruiting sergeant. And this is the famous Tammany Tiger. I took this one. Teresa does much better work, but you get the idea. The tiger was the emblem of the Tammany Fire Company, Tweed's Fire Company, and Nast worked with it and made it just a fearsome symbol of out-of-control corruption. Some of Nast's most deadly barbs were directed at poor Horace Greeley, whose only sin was accepting the Democratic nomination for president. And you can see what a target he makes. He wore the white coat, he had that hat, he had the granny glasses. And in his, I don't think you can read it, but he published a book called What I Know of Farming. Thank my colleague Eric Lundy for some background here. But in every cartoon, there are things in the book that says, what I know about bolting, shifting, stooping to conquer, whatever. He did not have a photograph of Gratz Brown, the vice presidential candidate, so he just tacked on a little tab there, and that's all you ever saw of Gratz Brown. But conciliatory healer as he was, he said, let us clasp hands over the bloody chasm. Okay, here's the first one, clasp hands over Andersonville prison. Nast really knew how to wave the bloody shirt. And here's another one. Having to produce a lot of cartoons, cartoonists are not afraid to repeat themselves. Here's the same theme. This time, it's a Tammany ruffian here. When Greeley died a month after his defeat, newspapers that had supported him were quick to blame Nast's relentless ridicule, although Greeley's strenuous campaign itinerary and his wife's protracted illness were contributing causes. Samuel Clemens wrote to Nast, you, more than any other man, have won a prodigious victory for Grant, I mean rather for civilization and progress. Those pictures were simply marvelous. Notice the ethnic stereotype, the Irishman with his hat there, which is not quite the Cobbine hat of the refugee, but not far. We don't see as much of this, mercifully, as we did in the late 19th century. This is a recent Pat Oliphant. Who is that? Big pardon? There's David Duke. Okay, Pat Buchanan. He's the central ruffian, the Reagan Minister of Disinformation, and there's Nixon. Sometimes Oliphant will draw him with that little derby hat. Also, as Oliphant's not afraid to hurt feelings. It was in the campaign against the Tweed Ring and Tammany Hall that he realized his full powers. William McGeer Boss Tweed allegedly tried to stop them damn pictures because he said, my constituents can't read, but damn it, they can see pictures. And I recommend to you Roger Fisher's fine revisionist work, Them Damn Pictures. One of the things he uncovered, it's revisionist. A lot of the information about NAST came from Albert Bigelow Payne's biography, which came in turn from interviews with NAST. And everybody always thought his Tweed's middle name was Marcy, but it was McGeer. Marcy was one of NAST's jokes. Marcy was the, William L. Marcy was the Jacksonian Democrat who was credited or blamed for the saying, to the victor belong the spoils. But so complete is NAST's triumph that the historical Tweed has been seriously altered. Great caricature. Lettuce, P-R-E-Y. This was published in 1876, and it shows Officer Tweed dragging the two street urchins into the Tammany Hall School of Reform. In 1875, Tweed escaped from jail and he fled to Spain, and he was arrested by Spanish customs officials who did not speak English, but they saw this cartoon and they figured this person must be wanted for kidnapping. He was arrested. He went back to the United States where he died in jail in 1878, although I think he was in the warden's suite, but still, he died in jail. So Them Damn Pictures had done him in. Fisher and others have noted that Nast's anti-Irish and anti-Catholic sentiments contributed to his crusading nature. I don't know if that's big enough. Take a look at the crocodiles. See, there's a face, there's a hand, and that's a bishop's mitre. and that's the heroic public school teacher who is going to the teeth of them. There's a whole bunch of they're after the school children. But anyway, there was maybe a little more than a little bigotry behind his altruism. This is from 1880. In later years, with Tweed gone and his heroes, Ulysses S. Grant retired, Nast lost his direction and his inspiration. His art and his temperament were more suited to war and moral crusades than day-to-day politics. For all he has done to make the political cartoonist a force to be reckoned with, for all the smoke and fury, for all the praise from presidents and writers, it is probably for this image that Nast is best remembered. I feel pretty Christmassy just looking at it. Okay, we'll move on to the middle period. Actually, Nast is in the middle period. Is that in focus, or is that? I guess it depends on where it is, doesn't it? You can see the faces better. This is Forbidding the Bands by Joseph Kepler for Puck in 1880. Kepler is the next giant of cartooning. And the situation is Uncle Sam is about to marry the Republican nominee James A. Garfield. Does anyone have any objections? And yes, the Democratic chairman runs in. Really can't read it, with the baby is labeled Credit Mobile, yay, $329, a reference to the scandal from the early 1870s. Apparently, Blaine had profited to the tune of $329, which is small potatoes by any political standards at any time. And that's what he said, it's such a little one. And so Kepler took the words, it's such a little one. And just the face on the candidate, the sort of simpering there. This was a highlight of the campaign of 1880, after which Kepler, I think you could say, supplanted Nast as America's premier cartoonist. Okay, the campaign of 1884, Kepler was a Democrat, and he and Puck revived an idea he had used against Grant. The Tattooed Man, and I don't know if you can read these corruption, anti-Chinese demagoguery, all sorts of things. It's an allusion to a popular middle-brow painting by the Frenchman Jerome, and the figures are very carefully caricatured. People would have been able to recognize them. Note the lighter, more flowery drawing style and the emphasis on humor as compared to Nast's heavier pencil and greater indignation. Kepler may be considered the founder of this school, which has alternated with Nast's in the evolution of editorial cartoons. And maybe this is the most telling shot in that cartoon War of 1884, the Royal Feast of Belshazzar, Blaine and the Money Kings. And it's the Last Supper. You can see they're feasting on patronage, lobby pudding. And this was, the artistry is not nearly as good as Kepler's work, certainly. Displayed on thousands of billboards around the state, the cartoon contributed to Blaine's defeat in New York by a mere 1,100 votes, and therefore in the national election. Although the revisionists have said, you can't really say that. Maybe it rained that day, but this is sort of the official look. This was one of the first use of these on such a wide scale. And according to Charles Press, this marked the real beginning of daily editorial cartooning as a profession. Reeling from these salvos, Republicans responded with Frank Beard's cartoon and Judge, dramatizing a rumor that Grover Cleveland was the father of an illegitimate child. 20 years later, scholars would say that this was the high water line of the element of purely personal abuse in comic art. And perhaps repenting, Frank Beard went on to draw Christian cartoons for the ram's horn. I'm maybe repenting his role in this. Okay, this is Grant Hamilton for Judge. Hearst's brand of yellow journalism was quite popular and widely imitated. Remember the Maine. Americans were endlessly fascinated by Mormon polygamy and the wide bed. There's another cartoon. Each wife is from a different race or ethnic group. Anyway, this is their memorial. Okay, continuing right along up into the 20th century. This may be kind of familiar around here. In the tradition of Thomas Nast, with his idealism and outrage rather than Kepler, with his satire and sheer humor, the radical cartoonists first came into prominence with their opposition to World War I. Several of these held high art credentials. John Sloan, for instance, who drew this cover, was an acclaimed artist of the Ashcan School. This is the sort of anti-war thing they did. Miner has another one of the officer scooping the brains out of the soldier's head is open and he's scooping the brains out. Robert Miner was one of the most notable of the radical cartoons. He simplified his style to increase the impact of the intensely political cartoons he drew for the masses. Ultimately, though, he gave up art to devote his time to working as a Communist Party official. He had created many powerful cartoons, though, and Liberator editor Joseph Freeman saw his style as creating a school of imitators, including worker cartoonist Fred Ellis, Daniel R. Fitzpatrick, Roland Kirby, and Jacob Burke. Okay, this is Anthony Comstock, the infamous secretary of the New York Society for the Prevention of Vice. Here's another prominent radical with a different style. Art Young probably achieved the widest distribution of all the radical cartoonists, partly because he was originally a Republican and came to socialism relatively late in life. after he had been on the staffs of several major newspapers. He was one of the Mass's first cartoonists. And with Mass's editor Max Eastman, Young was also sued unsuccessfully by the Associated Press for libel and was prosecuted in vain by the government under the Espionage Act for obstructing recruitment into the armed forces. All for democracy, all for Jesus. They all dance to the devil's orchestra of war. That's the end of the radical cartoonist, but I had to get Ollie Harrington in here. The style is not that different. Oliver Harrington is the first important African-American cartoonist. He had a BFA from Yale, began drawing in Harlem, was friends with some of the Harlem Renaissance figures. He's best known for Bootsy, his black little man who has comical situations and sharp observations. It was widely syndicated. During World War II, he was a war correspondent for the Pittsburgh Courier. Working for the NAACP after the war, he was so outspoken that a friend warned him that he had best leave the country or be prosecuted as a communist. So he went to Paris. He was in Paris. He was on a business trip when the Iron Curtain fell. And so he remained in East Berlin for quite a while. He drew for European publications and also the New York City People's Daily World. He came back to America briefly in 1972. And in 1992, as many of you remember, he was a visiting professor here. And he was home and received the acclaim that he deserved, and he died in 1995 in Berlin. And this is Daniel R. Fitzpatrick, the St. Louis Dispatch, again in the radical tradition, in the NAST tradition. As the swastika rolls over Poland. And in the same vein, Jacob Burke for the Chicago Sun-Times won a Pulitzer for this in 1940. And it's a neutral cartoon. A lot of the cartoons were either interventionist or more likely interventionist, but that's a little different. Okay. This is from Bill Malden, who is better known for Willie and Joe, his World War II characters. And after the war, he was sort of drifted artistically. But when the civil rights struggle became prominent, he fit right in with his artistic style and with his indignation, drawing this sort of thing. If you can't read the bottom caption, it's see you in church. This is from 1962. This is just a random thing from my own personal archives. This must have been on campus in 1968, and I Xeroxed it. But the cartoon, it doesn't have the heavy pencil of the radicals, but the idea of demonic Richard Nixon stomping grape workers as well as the grapes is appealing. Same thing 20 years later, the things you find on campus. This is by Matt Werker, W-E-R-K-E-R, and I don't know if somebody here just picked it up and made a rude poster out of it, but the son of Regenstein, and Werker is still drawing, not too widely distributed, but he is still prominent. And I had remembered this from The Realist in the 60s, and I came across it again downstairs in Special Collections, and how very surprised I was to see a familiar signature, Dick Gendon, as I had not known that he was a radical cartoonist. But another way of looking at the First World, Second World, Third World situation. Can I? Oh, 63? Do you have any idea why? Now, I think 63. I don't have the rest of the page I took the Xerox from. I'd have to look down there and see if there's more of his. To look at some of the symbols, James Montgomery Flagg's Uncle Sam is one of the best known, and we don't There are many articles and books even on the evolution of Uncle Sam from Brother Jonathan on. But this is very recognizable, and there's been so much fun to parody. Uncle Lyndon wants you. That's Blaine. He's a Canadian, but okay, we'll let him make cartoons about us. Here are a couple old, or one old standard, old favorite, the Trusts. Frederick Burr Opper on the left has a lighter touch to them, and Homer Davenport, the barbarian with the whip there. Today, an international conglomerate is too large, too abstract, I think, to be symbolized or maybe even conceived. So I'm not aware, at least, of seeing symbols about this. Okay, this is the first Democratic donkey, 1837. And Nast used the fox for the Democratic Party in general, and he used the donkey to represent the Copperheads. Okay, in 1874, Nast first began to represent his party as an elephant. He did so out of disappointment with its loss of ideals and increasing corruption. There it's running amok, and that's still a very recognizable symbol. You don't see that many donkeys in cartoons. You do some of the older cartoonists. So there's the elephant, and yet he has the striped suit and the cufflinks of the Trusts. Liberated from the shackles of welfare enslavement and embraced by a spirit of tough love, poor Americans are set free to fly. Flight training, however, was deemed too costly for the current budget. There's Joseph Kepler again. There's the spirit of old man prohibition. And when prohibition actually came, Roland Kirby converted it to Mr. Dry, same sort of thing, and the heavy pencil marks there. Okay, let's take a look at illusions. You, a bevy of Hamlets to look at. Cartoonist Signe Wilkinson wrote about a shrinking pool of shared imagery resulting from poor education, and concerning a youth who did not understand a cartoon about the Golden Rule, which he didn't know what it was, Wilkinson said, "Pretty soon the only people I will be able to refer to are Beavis and Butthead." And Pat Oliphant shares her opinion of the always diminishing field of reference, as the riches of literature along the lessons of history have largely been ignored by present educators. He blames these educators for selling out and abandoning our cultural heritage, for not providing the historical perspective without which satire is impossible. He's not talking about any of us, I'm sure. But just a bunch of Hamlets here. And there's another one. There's General McClellan. In 1864, it's a little scary. There are still a few cartoonists who will dare to draw Hamlet. Alas, poor Agnew, Mitchell, Stans, Ehrlichman, on and on. This is Paul Conrad, who is of the older generation. He is retired, but he still draws and is still widely syndicated in the Los Angeles Times. And Draper Hill is certainly not afraid to try a little Shakespeare with a pun or play on words thrown in. And there's still the occasional allusion to Greek mythology. Cartoonists in recent years have found fewer literary works which might be widely recognized. Or maybe at least people learn to recognize allusions. It was the best of times. It was like the worst of times. Whatever. And if I don't think you can read some of the titles, possible titles. Interns are from Venus. Presidents are from Mars. The Tapes of Wrath. Alice in Wonderland, as illustrated by Englishman John Tenniel over a century ago, still has resonance. Off with his head. And here's Oliphant's version of it. We don't have time to talk about it here, but there are a lot of cartoons bashing Hillary Rodham Clinton. Okay, presidential mythology is another is widely traded currency. Here, President Clinton is writing his apology in legalese. I committed no illegality in denying having chopped down the tree, but I look upon that as a private matter anyway. I saw a couple which actually had the cherry tree there, but I again did not have my scissors with me. What they said, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall, and I revert to my former statement. And that's Steve Benson, who's obviously a Republican. Here's what a Democrat makes of the Gipper. You may as well have a Millard Fillmore monument and a Robert E. Lee memorial if you're going to have a Ronald Reagan airport. This is pre-impeachment with a little cinematic illusion and this show me the money campaign scandal. Here we go. Now we're into the impeachment. Presidential memorials, presidential libraries, this sort of thing, are also widely recognized, a good way for getting comparison. And this is Doug Marlette, who is a liberal, the temptation to draw these is just irresistible. You'll recall Kepler with his tattooed man alluding to a popular painting. In the last part of the 20th century, we get Disney, Clinocchio. This is an endless cliche. It would certainly be possible to fill a book with these, but to what point? I don't know. Joel Pett is the editor of the American Association of Editorial Cartoonists, and they have a newsletter, and they give an award every year for cliches, and you'll have several Pinocchios, five Titanics, even before the movie, and then, of course, the year, and they deplore this sort of thing. But okay, that's the Southern Baptist. As the cartoonists had a lot of fun with them, and we're behind. We won't even name anymore. Okay, who's the man with the phaser? Okay, Governor Jerry Brown. I couldn't find it, but I'm almost positive there is a cartoon of him in his Star Trek uniform saying, "Beam me up, Scotty." And this is the insidious, I guess, thing about the editorial cartoonists. He is permanently, and of course the other comedians help too, but he is permanently labeled as a flake, a space cadet. Dan Quayle is dumb. Even the Steve Benson, an ardent conservative Republican, cannot resist doing Quayle is dumb jokes. Doonesbury is excited. He's breaking into his regular strip with the latest Quayleism. Okay, let's see what you do with this one. Okay, I was going to start doing the dueling banjos clip. It's a little disconcerting as to why either Sally Jesse Raphael or Geraldine Ferraro was in the canoe with Bill Clinton. But yeah, if you've seen or read Deliverance, Ken Starr up there as the idiot savant from Dueling Banjo, and Bill said, uh-oh. Explains a lot. This is Bruce Plant of the Chattanooga Times. Then there are commercials, Endless Energizer Bunnies. This is Oliphant. I think there are three of them in this one volume. Every time it's Bob Dole, and there's a different campaign, and Dole is still in the damn drumming. On and on. And I don't know what scholars will make of this in 100 years. If you don't watch TV, if you don't see the Bud Light commercials, that's it. Somebody better write these things down while we can. Next, I'll do some topical references here. As the editorial cartoons have always emphasized the topical from the Boston Massacre on. Well, I'm getting way behind here. In 1859, Frenchman Charles Blondin crossed the Niagara Falls on a tightrope, and the metaphor was just irresistible, metaphor for politics. There's Horace Greeley saying, don't drop the carpet bag. Okay, there's an African-American in the bag. Here's a Currier and Ives. Would take us all day to do the dialogue. There's the Salt River of Defeat. That's another reference that we have lost. I don't know if it's any great loss. But everything is labeled, a lot of dialogue balloons. Let's see, and yet another one. As the quote Negro question was very big in Lincoln's candidacy, so this has the coming man, and it's always a question what Lincoln will do. And here's just a random local cartoon from the 50s, somebody on a tight rope. Can you read her shirt? Hillary Rodham Harding. This is Steve Benson again. Excuse me. And hey, here, how about more Tanya Harding, the CIA spy? That's the sore foot. Here is Benson again. And there's Bill being soft on crime. In the outline, I promised something about Lorena Bobbitt. I don't have any Lorena Bobbitt cartoons, although you'll still see an occasional Hillary Rodham Bobbitt cartoon, as that situation seems to have touched a national nerve. Okay, this story, I'm sure most of you remember it. When Newt Gingrich's first wife was in the hospital with cancer, Newt came in to have her sign the divorce papers. This is Mike Lukovich's cartoon. In this case, the metaphor is the Georgia constituents, and he is deserting them for the high rollers. Lukovich is one of our most popular and funniest cartoonists. He's probably the most frequently anthologized in Newsweek. And what goes around comes around. Now Newt is sick, and the Republicans are divorcing him. There's a lot of backstabbing metaphors also there. Let me just do a few presidents. There's FDR, the Riddle of the Sphinx. There were several cartoons at the time when he was trying the third term question. And of course, the famous cigarette in the holder. And by implication, Draper Hill makes just a little comparison here that he's no, great socks there, that he is no, Bill Clinton is no FDR. Okay, there's Lyndon Johnson. And for anybody who doesn't remember the historical reference, they make fun of Bill Clinton because he admitted that he wears briefs instead of boxers. Lyndon Johnson showed the reporters his gallbladder scar, and the gallbladder scar here is in the shape of Vietnam. And that's worth 1,000 words if that picture, if you remember the historical situation. That's David Levine. You have to have some Herblock. Nixon was bothered and bedeviled by Herblock. It upset him considerably. Welcome, and here he comes out of the sewer. Can you read? There's Ehrlichman, Magruder, and John Dean, all of them. And nothing so obvious as a caption, "What a tangled web we weave." You don't need it. The graphics do it all. I'm very sorry, I could not find one of Mike Peters' cartoons of Jerry Ford as Frankenstein with the bolt in the side of his head. And there's Mr. Peanut there. This is Uri Hofmeckler, obviously a caricaturist. The cartoonists just love Ronald Reagan. You had the pompadour, the big ears, the waddles, all this stuff. He'd been in all the movies, so that cowboy stuff, the Gipper, war movies, and he liked those awful, ugly sport coats. Okay, that takes us up. Okay, here's Willie. And again, I recommend this publication and also editor and publisher if you're interested in nuts and bolts details about the profession. After Clinton beat Bush in 1992, at first the cartoonists weren't sure what to do. Okay, he liked Elvis, he played the saxophone, and he had sort of a pre-bulbous nose, although under the pens of the cartoonists it became quite bulbous in a hurry. And there was some talk, oh, editorial cartoonists are liberal. Oh, they'll just coddle him. Mm-hmm. And, of course, they laughed also. They knew what would happen. Recently, at least, this is about as mild as it gets. Do you have anything in middle-sized crimes and misdemeanors? Okay, since hardly anybody felt like defending President Clinton, those sympathetic to him attacked the Republicans. Whom David Letterman characterized as what a bunch of nosebleeds. And as they've said, Clinton was very fortunate in his choice of enemies. This is Jack Oman. I subscribe to the school of overhead verite. I could have taken the label off, but I didn't want to. And I do want to plug this magazine, Comic Relief. It's a good source of cartoons and things that are syndicated. Old Dave Barry's, Dilbert's, Doonesbury's. So there's the Republican elephant. This is Tom Tolis. That's his little signature. Give him enough trunk. And here are more. Lynch him, string him up. No, it's not working. And Jeff McNally is a conservative, but he couldn't resist this. And I saw a couple of Houdinis, but I could not find them. There's never a pair of scissors around when you need them, I guess. But we have this, Acme impeachment kit. I like the artwork on this one better. There were also quite a few with cigars, exploding cigars, one in Clinton's face, Starr's face, the elephant's face. Rather than show them, I just wore the cigar to kind of stand for all of them. And Clinton is frequently pictured with a cigar and often without pants also. Okay. Uh, Notice the fine lines and the good humor to get back to this business of the Nast School versus the Kepler. There's the history writing. There's no indignation here. Break out the broads, free at last. And there's a little trademark Oliphant's Punk the Penguin. The moving finger writes, and having writ, moves on. In 1992, Oliphant said that George Bush had to go. And he was generally for Clinton. Did any of you see Oliphant 2 years ago? Madison College brought him in. Anyway, a wonderful show. He'd be up there and he'd make a few lines and people say, oh, Barry Goldwater. And he'd do a few, Menachem Begum. He'd do his greatest hits and he'd just do part of them and everybody would get them. But one of the things he said is that Clinton is boring, but his scandals are getting better. Scandals, China, the Millennium, Paula Jones, I can't wait. And he didn't have to wait very long at all. It's difficult for an editorial cartoonist to defend. It's just not in the nature of the beast. Nast tried picturing President Grant as a lion. There's a whole book of cartoons showing a smiling President Eisenhower playing golf, but it just doesn't ring true. It's not funny. And I think we respond to the meanness.